If you would like a free newsletter on this or other subjects, just give us a call at Christian Answers. The phone number is area code 512-218-8022. That's 512-218-8022. Or you could email us at cdebater@aol.com. That's cdebater@aol.com.
We're going to spend time talking about creation and how it relates to science. And certainly, I would like to first extend an invitation to those of you who may be skeptics today who think creation is a mere hoax of Christianity or any other religion, that you take an opportunity today to call and talk to some folks who know much more about it than I do, the experts in the field. And we have an expert joining us here in the studio today. His name is Dr. Michael Gerard, and he's with the Institute for Creation Research, and we're glad to have you here.
Glad to be here.
We appreciate it. We also have with us in the studio Larry Wessels, and welcome to you all. We appreciate you being here.
Good to be here.
I know that that he's going to be here in town this week and is going to be speaking, and we'll get to that in a bit, and I'll give you plenty of opportunity to let folks know about that. In the meantime, let's just start with this issue, because it's something I think, I see your shirt there, Jehovah's Park. I think, obviously, a takeoff on Jurassic Park. I think that really, to this generation, once again, brought to everybody's mind, did dinosaurs ever exist? Did they exist when man existed? How does that all fit together with the idea of creation? Why don't you just give us your thoughts on Jurassic Park and the impact it made on the country?
All of these movies that promote dinosaurs being such a tremendous rage, especially with young people, enforces in their mind this concept of two things. Number one, hundreds of millions of years, an old age of the Earth, that things go on, just as 2 Peter 3 says, things have gone on from the beginning. The second thing that we see with that, so the old age is the first thing that the concept of dinosaurs promotes. The second thing it promotes is what you built on top of old age, and that's evolution. That the dinosaurs evolved from some primitive creature, that they became extinct, and that man is finally here by some fortunate good luck mistake of evolution. So it's an emphasis of the two major things that draws people's attention away from the scriptures, the age of the earth and the concept of evolution. And it's interesting, looking at it from a biblical standpoint, if I can step out from the scientific aspect, from a biblical standpoint, and that's really what the impact is, 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 3 through 6 says that in the latter days, there'll come scoffers walking after their own lusts, saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. For this they are willingly ignorant of, that the world that then was standing in the water and out of the water, and the world that then was being overflowed with water perished. Wasn't reading it. But the main point is that in 2 Peter 3, verses 3 through 6, you have four things that people will question in the last days. Second coming of Christ, age of the earth, instantaneous creation, just as God said by the word of God, with the earth sitting in the water, not a big bang, but a big splash, and a worldwide flood. And three of those four things deal with this area of creation science, and that is exactly what we're seeing. Now, Peter wrote that over 1,900 years ago, and we're seeing that prophecy, I believe, fulfilled right now. But this is what people hang their hat on to say, I disregard every bit of the Bible. Talks about evolution, talks about the age of the earth, and because the Bible discounts what the scientists are telling us is true, the Bible must be false. And the statement I get all the time, I call it the Genesis excuse. If the Bible lies in the very first verse, how can you trust any of the rest of it? Mm-hmm. So this whole idea of Jurassic Park promoting very old ages and the concept of evolution is has had an effect to greatly diminish people's belief in what the scriptures say. And I want to emphasize this, both Christian and non-Christian.
Let me go for a moment to the very issue of creation or evolution or any other thought along those lines. I have people call all the time who put forth their thoughts about old earth and about evolution and so forth and so on. I believe, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on it, it takes just as much faith, if not more, to believe in those theories as it does to believe in creation.
Absolutely. Let me give you some numbers and statistics. H.J. Morowitz is considered one of the world's most renowned physical chemists. He is an evolutionist, so I want to preface it by saying that. He calculated the odds of forming one E. coli bacteria, just one, any place in the universe in a 5 billion year time period. He said the chance was one chance in 10 to the 100 billionth power. That's a one with 100 billion zeros behind it. Now, the national debt is a 5 with only 12 zeros behind it. But this man is talking about one chance in 10 to the 100 billionth power, a 1 with 100 billion zeros behind it. You've got to have incredible faith to believe that. The French mathematician statistician Emile Borel says you get above a probability of 10 to the 50th power, you're looking at events that will never, ever occur. So those events, by definition, go beyond the natural. Once you get above 10 to the one chance in 10 to the 50th power, you're looking at one chance in 10 to the 100 billionth power. And that's just one E. coli bacteria. That's a supernatural event.
One of the things that that I think is concerning to many people is that even among the Christian ranks, even among those who believe in creation, there are a lot of different thoughts about creation. You have people who believe that each day was actually an eon of time, and that there were gaps in there, and that possibly it was a combination of creation and evolution. So even within the Christian and conservative community that would look at creation and say, yes, God created the heavens and the earth, but then they split off on all these other things, even in Christians' minds, it's not settled.
That's exactly right. And if you look at the historical development of that, in other words, what caused a Christian to believe that a day wasn't a day? What would make anyone believe that God couldn't communicate in a way that I could understand? It was historically a case of the scientist looking at this evidence and then putting his own interpretation on the evidence and then going back to the theologian and saying, your Bible does not fit my interpretation. Obviously, God must be wrong. Well, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for someone who doesn't know everything, who hasn't always been there, who hasn't seen everything, to go to someone who has always been there, who does know everything, and tell him what he really means. The Bible, both scientifically and hermeneutically, means just what it says. When we see that day in Genesis, that Hebrew word, yom, can only have one of three meanings. It can mean an indefinite period of time, the daylight portion of a day, or a 24-hour period. And we know that it doesn't mean an indefinite period because we have day one, day two, day three. We know it's not just the daylight portion of a day because it says the evening and the morning, or the first day, the second day, etc. So that only leaves one other option, a literal 24-hour day. And that fits perfectly with what the scriptures say. But again, historically, this whole development that I think has caused tremendous confusion in the body of Christ has come about by Christians asking the scientists, what did God really mean? Instead of asking God, well, what did you really mean? Does your book give me enough information to figure that out?
In studio with us today, Dr. Mike Girod of the Institute for Creation Research and also Larry Wessels. We're talking about creation and all of the things involved with creation that you'd like to talk about. We can do that today.
The originator, the discoverer of the DNA, Dr. Crick, he said, well, he's discovered that you can't have life evolve on this planet, so he's taken it out to outer space, said, well, it must have evolved there. But he doesn't get away from the problem that it had to, well, how did it evolve on the other planets? Mm-hmm. So he thinks, well, if I can get it out in outer space, nobody will think about it. Meanwhile, we pump billions of dollars to NASA to try to find UFOs and all sorts of stuff like that, mm-hmm. when the answer's right here in the Bible. And I think it's a great witnessing tool to have these evidences. People called in on our show last Saturday night and just filled up the phone lines all 2 hours. And it's great because people have been told that the Bible isn't true because evolution refutes it. So what you do is you give them the evidence, say, hey, that's not true. Evolution isn't true. Creation is true. And then they'll be open to listen to you when you present the gospel. And I think many, many people have come to the Lord that way, especially in our scientific age. Mm-hmm. So it's very important that we know these evidences and how to refute evolution.
And so much right now in our generation, scientists have become the priests. If it's on National Geographic, if it's written up in the newspaper as being something that a scientist said, well, it can't be false. It absolutely has to be true. And people look at that as being definitive. Well, if folks want to look at scientific evidence, there's so much overwhelming evidence for creation, so much overwhelming evidence to completely overturn this belief of evolution that they just need to become familiar with it.
And unfortunately, terribly unfortunately, they've even gone to looking at the television news, and they look at people who were trained in journalism who are all of a sudden experts on the environment telling them that the world's going to collapse, the greenhouse effect or something. They'll believe anybody.
Well, and they, at the same time, they could get a real real scientific opinion on the environment, because now the vice president is an expert in the environment.
Let's go to the phones and take some calls. Bob, you're on Direct Line. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hello.
First, Larry and Dale, God bless you guys, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Dr. Girard.
Hello.
I heard you yesterday on In Defense of the Faith. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to get through. But if I recall, you mentioned that you are a medical doctor.
Right.
And you gave up your practice. I think that's a marvelous testimony to the Lord Jesus Christ that a young man such as yourself would give up what was undoubtedly a lucrative practice to support creation and the Word of God.
Well,
that in itself is a tremendous testimony. But I should also say to you that we've been supporters of ICR for some 15 years now. I got involved with ICR back when we lived in San Diego many years ago, and I've learned an enormous amount over the years from their impact articles and books. But there's one particular area that I have not been able to find anything on that has been a perplexing thing to me for some years, and I wanted to ask if you could give me ICR's position on it or refer me maybe to one of their references or documents that I might be able to read. And that has to do with the distance to the nearest stars, as we understand them in science, versus the speed of light at 186,000 miles per second, you know the arithmetic, which leads one to the conclusion, if we believe the speed of light as it has been measured, and we believe that the nearest star that we're looking at is, for purposes of conversation, I don't remember the actual number, we'll say it's 100 million light years away.
Does this pertain to the redshift and things of that nature?
Well, yeah.
I hate to interrupt you.
And of course, anybody on the panel there, but specifically Dr. Girard, if he knows and can relate to me, ICR's position or answer to the scientists that say that because the nearest star is X millions of miles away, or light years away,
okay,
and we're looking at it.
Bob, I have to cut you off. We are almost out of time for this hour. Let's get him to respond to that as quickly as he can, and we'll try and address it.
Bob, that's a great question. As you know, Barry Setterfield and Trevor Norman had proposed that the speed of light had decreased. Polish astrophysicist by the name of Bellard had also done that, and a Russian physicist by the name of Trotsky mathematically demonstrated that in his model of the Big Bang, you would expect a decrease in the speed of light, and possibly could have been thousands or millions of times faster in the past. The big question that's confronted creation scientists is that if we believe what the evolutionists are telling us, and this may or may not be true, that we're seeing stars that are 15 billion light years away, then it took 15 billion years for that light to travel here if light's always traveled at the same speed. However, believe it or not, I think the answer resides in a secular journal. Two NASA scientists writing in the February 1993 edition of Sky and Telescope magazine talk about how the redshift, by which we measure the distance and the speed at which stars are receding from us, how that redshift is not what we've always been taught in school, but how it only fits with a model of general relativity. And if there was a Big Bang, or not necessarily a Big Bang, but if the scriptures are right, when God says that he stretched out the heavens like a scroll, and he says that in many places, that he stretched out like a scroll or a tent, then according to general relativity, that space in stretching those stars way, way distant from us, the space could move 1,000 times faster than the speed of light because the space doesn't contain energy or matter. Now, I know that's kind of hard to visualize, but imagine blowing up a balloon. Put two dots in your balloon and now blow it up. It appears that the dots move further away, but in general relativity, it would take light the same distance to move between those two points, whether or not they were close or far away, because it wasn't the light that moved. In effect, it was the space that carried the light. So that everything could have been created very recently, our universe could be expanding very quickly, and, excuse me, it could be just like the scripture said, God stretching out the heavens.
Here's an interesting quote from a professor, Lewis, I just forgot the name, but Barone, who is an evolutionist, very, very well-respected man as far as his credentials go. I won't take time to read them, but he said this, quote, "Evolutionism is a fairy tale for grown-ups. This theory has helped nothing in the progress of science. It is useless." And I think that pretty much wraps up the views of most of those in this room, at least, and we will talk more about that today. Our guest in studio, Dr. Michael Girard of the Institute for Creation Research, and we were talking about many things. We've had a caller holding through the break, so let's get to him first, and then we'll get back to some of the other discussions that we've been talking about. F.H., thank you for holding. You're on direct line.
Well, I appreciate that, and I appreciate the privilege to hold on to listen to something like this because even though I'm what you might class as an older citizen, I'm a bit, what you'd say, I admit I'm a baby Christian and have a lot to learn and a lot to understand. So what I try to do is focus on the fact that Jesus is Lord and focus on the story of the cross and his saving blood and not try to get confused with all this other stuff. But to me, evolution has always been a lie, the biggest lie. I called in a week or so ago on one of your shows about it being the biggest lie ever perpetrated on mankind. And then someone asked me, well, how do you explain away dinosaurs and prehistoric man? I couldn't answer that. I never even thought about it. And all I know is I didn't swing out of a tree. And it's kind of twofold. We're taught that all the way through our life, and it's ingrained in us. And then I read, like in Hosea 4:6, where it says, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. So the twofold question is how to explain away the dinosaurs and the prehistoric man information that's been drilled into us for so many years, and then what happens to the people that are, innocently hit by that? I'm not quite able to put all it together, and I'm sure you can for me.
That's a good question.
That is a great question. I guess dinosaurs, how they fit with the Bible, is one of the biggest questions that we're asked because we're taught by television that those dinosaurs lived millions of years ago. Whenever a scientist tells me about things that happened millions of years ago, I always like to ask them the same question that God asked Job. Were you there? When a scientist tells me about things that happened millions of years ago, the first thing you need to ask them is, well, wait a minute, did you see that? Did your friend see it? Were you there? How do you know it took millions of years? Now, when I go to the Bible, I have a book written by someone who was there. God has always been there. He knows everything. He's seen everything. And God is able to give me truth about things that happened in the past. God is the best eyewitness because he never lies. So when I start with the word of someone who knows everything, who's always been there, and I can find the answers to my questions. Now, let's jump to dinosaurs. The book of Job was written about a gentleman that lived after the great flood. And in that book, in chapter 40, around verse 15 through 17, God tells his friend Job to look at an animal. Now, that animal must have existed if God told Job to look at it. He says, Job, behold now behemoth, which I made with you. He eats grass as an ox. He moves his tail like a cedar tree. Now, there's only one animal I know that has a tail like a cedar tree, and that's a dinosaur. I've read different Bible commentaries. Some of them say, well, that's a hippopotamus. And I say, well, wait a minute, a hippopotamus doesn't have a tail like a cedar tree. Or a very good Bible commentary says that that's an elephant. Well, that's the wrong end of the elephant. As you read in Job chapter 40 about how tremendous this animal is and how he could drink up the Jordan with his mouth, obviously what you're looking at is one of the brontosaur type of dinosaurs. Job chapter 41 talks about another tremendously large creature called Leviathan. And quite possibly that was also one of the sea-dwelling creatures that, according to the evolutionists, lived at that time. So the Bible tells us that someone after the flood saw dinosaurs. Now the question that we're so often asked is this. Well, are you implying that Noah brought dinosaurs in the ark? And the answer is definitely. Noah didn't bring the biggest dinosaurs, he brought the baby dinosaurs. And the reason why Noah knew to bring the baby dinosaurs is because God brought the animals to Noah. So God would have brought to Noah the creatures that would have fit on the ark. If the dinosaurs went on the ark and came off the ark after the flood, we see that we have one eyewitness in the book of Job, but what about other eyewitnesses? Believe it or not, the Greek historian Herodotus, writing in the 3rd century B.C., gives a perfect description of a Rhamphorhynchus flying dinosaur on his travels to Egypt. 8th century European history books describe creatures that fit perfectly with the description of dinosaurs. And in 1980, Dr. Roy Mackel, going to the middle of the Congo looking for an animal that the natives over there called Mkembelemembe, found a creature that according to him, is a very large brontosaur type of dinosaur. I said it's huge. It's enormous. There's no way to get alive one back. So there are eyewitnesses to dinosaurs. The Indian legends in America of the Thunderbird fits the description of a pteranodon, a pterodactyl type of flying dinosaur. There are petroglyphs out in Utah that actually showed these dinosaurs. So it appears that dinosaurs have always lived with man, and we still get stories today from people who claim to have seen dinosaurs.
I would like to mention also that there, in the Illustrated London News of February 9, 1856, page 166, it was reported by workmen digging a railway tunnel in France last century. They disturbed a huge winged creature at Caumont in Haute-Marne. Now, this is in France, of course, while blasting rock for the tunnel. The creature was described as livid black with a long neck and sharp teeth. It looked like a bat, and its skin was thick and oily. It died soon after. Its wingspan measured at 3.22 meters, that's 10 feet 7 inches. A naturalist immediately recognized it as belonging to the genus Pterodactylus annus, and it matched the remains of known pterodactyl fossils. And there's just more stories than we could even get into. There's not enough time on the radio show, obviously, that we could bring up pertaining to these events. I think they've even captured a Japanese fisherman 30 years ago, captured what do you call those?
A plesiosaur. There's a picture
right.
of that in the book, The Great Dinosaur Mystery. And when you write to ICR and get their book list, you may want to get that book or the video, which is outstanding.
Right, and they thought that was extinct like 70 million years ago.
Right.
What happened to the dinosaurs?
What happened to the dinosaurs? We find fossils of dinosaurs, and we believe they were all extinct. And again, we presented evidence to show that probably we still have some dinosaurs alive. They lived at least through the 3rd century B.C. The Book of Job was written. Mackel says that there's still dinosaurs. The Loch Ness Monster and the plesiosaur that was actually caught off the coast of New Zealand in 77 all show that dinosaurs probably are not all extinct. Most of them are, maybe all of them are, simply because after the worldwide flood, spoken about in the book of Genesis, the climate changed drastically and the dinosaurs did what 95% of all the species in the world have done. That is, become extinct. 95% of all species that have ever lived, according to the fossil record, are now extinct, according to Dr. Ernst Mayr. So what we're seeing is just a small percentage of what was originally out there.
You mentioned the fossil record, and that's something that many people point to. I think probably many people who are not familiar with it point to say, well, we've got the fossil record, so obviously it's a fact. Evolution is a fact. Can you speak for a moment to the fossil record?
The fossil record is the greatest, if you would, embarrassment to the evolutionist. And according to the evolutionist, right here in Texas, the fossil record has provided a formal disproof of evolution, not based upon creationist criteria, but based upon the evolutionist criteria. The theory of evolution says that over millions or hundreds of millions of years, one kind of creature gradually changes into a different kind. A snake turns into a bird. But in between, you've got a whole bunch of half-snake, half-birds, snurds, running around. And that as these critters die, you ought to have a fossil record full of in-between forms. Not snake, not bird, but something in between. Back home, we would have half-cat, half-dog, and we call that a dat. That's why people go to Saints game, hope the science, who dat. And Charles Darwin, when he first proposed this theory, said we need to find those in-between forms. That's what his whole theory rested upon. But he said the most serious objection to his theory was that at that time, in 1859, there were none of those in-between forms. Well, we're over 130 years past Darwin, and if you read what the evolutionist experts in the fossil record print, they admit the same thing, that there are no in-between forms, transitional forms, in the fossil record. Stephen Jay Gould, who is a vehement anti-creationist, admits that the absence of fossil intermediaries in the fossil record is the trade secret of paleontology. Sir Colin Paterson, senior paleontologist at the British Natural History Museum, wrote a book on evolution, gave no examples of transitional forms. Lou Sunderland from this country wrote and asked him, where are your examples? Paterson wrote him back and said, if I knew of any examples, I would have included them in my book. He said, I'll lay it on the line. There was not one fossil for which one could make a watertight argument. Over and over again.
But doctor, there's so few fossils that they found. It's probably still waiting. The jury's still out to find more fossils. Is that correct?
Well, you could say that. When Charles Darwin made that claim, that was legitimate. But we have found billions of fossils. Dr. Robert Broom says at the Cairo Supergroup in Africa, he has 800 billion, B as in boy, billion fossils out there. 800 billion. So we have found fossils enormous numbers of fossils, what we never find are transitional forms. Not because I say it, but because the evolutionist says it. And it's incredible that when you speak to kids that are in high school and college, especially college graduates, and ask them for their evidence of evolution, that is the first thing they turn to. Just a little story. I was at Houston's restaurant back home in New Orleans when then the little lady that was waiting on me was working on her master's degree in biology at Tulane University. And we got to talking about creation evolution, of course, and I asked her for her best evidence for evolution. And she said, the fossil record. And I said, you must be kidding me. I said, what is in the fossil record that impressed? She said, well, all of the transitional forms, especially the ape men. And I sat down with her for about 5 minutes and went through all the different ape men and showed her why none of these things are accepted as being transitional forms and a revolution in the evolutionary community right now, that evolutionists are saying these things are not ape men. And she was astounded. She said, well, that's not what I was taught. And it's very, very disappointing for me to see the colleges and universities not getting that information to young people, censoring that information out, and worse yet, to turn on television every Christmas. I don't know if you've noticed, National Geographic gets on there and does a special on ape men, trying to convince kids that they are made in the image of an ape.
Could you tell us for a moment some of these ape men, like Nebraska Man, Piltdown Man, some of these so-called ancestors of man?
Well, of course, everybody jumps on Neanderthal Man. Dr. C. Loring Brace is probably the most respected authority on Neanderthal Man, having studied 2,000 fossil specimens, not just of Neanderthal, but of the hominids in general. Dr. Brace said in the September 11th, 1989 edition of Insight magazine, quote, Neanderthal Man is modern Western European. He made the claim that Neanderthal man was no different than modern Western European. Mm-hmm. Neanderthal man is generally accepted now as just being modern man. Mm-hmm. Some of the bony changes in the skull and the legs, we now know from the work of Strauss and Ivanhoe, were due to vitamin D deficiency. We know that the curvature of the back was due to arthritis. All of this work has been done and demonstrated scientifically, experimentally. Neanderthal man was simply man. Cro-Magnon man. We see Cro-Magnon man whenever we see a picture, which, and let me say this, when we see pictures in a museum, we're not seeing an actual photograph. It's like when we dig up fossils, we've never dug up a birth certificate with a fossil. We really don't know how old those fossils are. But when we see pictures in a museum, we're looking at what an artist's impression is about that. That's what he thinks. Cro-Magnon man at the caves in Lascaux-Les Chateau drew pictures of himself, and he wasn't this big, ugly, hairy, long-bearded creature. In Lascaux-Les Chateau, he had top hat, wore a suit, the women wore pants suits, carried purses. That doesn't make the news, but that's well known. Java man, Eugene Dubois find, turned out to be what he called just a large orang. Concealed evidence that he found that would have completely disproved his claim that it was an ape man. Peking man, all the evidence was stolen, but it appears to have been man's meal, not man's ancestor, because they only found skulls bashed in from the rear and the base of the skull, and the early descriptions of the skull describe Peking man as being a small triangular skull reminiscent of the apes. So when you don't have any evidence, when you just have models that were made from people's afterthoughts, then you can make it appear to be anything you want. Of course, Lucy is the biggest find right now, this Australopithecine that was found by Donald Johansson. But again, what the kids are not told in school is that Dr. Adrian Zillman back in 1981 showed in New Scientist magazine that Lucy's skeleton is virtually identical to a green forest pygmy chimpanzee. But they don't give you research grant money to find green forest pygmy chimpanzees. No ape men, none whatsoever.
Well, why and how does our society continue with that that as background on the so-called ape men? How can they look at that? How can scientists continue, and how can our schools continue to teach and our institutions continue to teach this as fact?
There's several factors that are involved. Number one, you can continue to perpetuate the myth if you can successfully censor out all the other information. A Discover magazine went down to Glen Rose, Texas, where you have human footprints inside of dinosaur footprints, which were made within 2 hours of each other, now demonstrated to be not a fake, not a carving, but documented human footprint inside of a dinosaur footprint. According to the evolutionists, Richard Dawkins, Eugenie Scott, Stephen M. Stanley, Dr. Stanley is a very well-renowned evolutionary paleontologists. If that's true, it would be a formal disproof of evolution. The evidence is there. Discover magazine went down there several years ago, shot 7 hours of footage, none of it made it on TV. Censorship, plain and simple. The people who teach in the colleges and universities, and I know several instances where teachers have come to the realization that evolution is false and were either asked to step down or were simply dismissed. You have to cling to the party line, and the evolutionists themselves admit that. Scientific American article by Jeffrey Burbidge, 1992, talks about this censorship and this... I'm searching for a word I can't find, how professors and scientists who don't conform to the party line, who don't say what everybody must say, are denied access to equipment, dismissed from universities, etc. There's a tremendous prejudice in the colleges and universities. But the overlying question is this: why? If we're scientists and we're being good scientists, shouldn't we just put all of the evidence on the table and examine it? I mean, if you came to my hospital emergency room tonight, would you want me to look at all of the lab work that I got back on you?
Sure.
And that seems reasonable.
But, Doctor, scientists, people that believe in evolution, scientists, I mean, we know that no good scientist could be a creationist, but you know how they date, let's say, fossils to be millions of years old based on a strata. We're going with geological terms here. The strata tells us how old they are. Doesn't this prove that evolution must be true?
And again, we date the rocks by the fossils and the fossils by the rocks, to quote James O'Rourke. He's an evolutionist. It's circular reasoning. The biggest problem with evolution, though, and I think this is what people need to understand, especially Christians, evolution is not science. An evolutionist, a man by the name of Sir Karl Popper, who's been called the greatest philosopher of science who ever lived, said that evolution was a metaphysical research program and not a scientific theory. When evolution is taught, evolution's not taught, it's evangelized. And evolution has served as the, quote, scientific justification for things such as Roe v. Wade. The theory of recapitulation, which is listed as one of the five pillars of evolutionary proof, was the scientific basis for Roe v. Wade. If humans are just more highly evolved animals, then they aren't special. They aren't different. If man is made in the image of an ape, then suicide, euthanasia, murder is acceptable.
I would just like to comment on the fact that evolution is just a man being rebellious against God. He's a sinner. That he, what he does is want to explain God away. If you can explain God away, then you don't have to submit to the authority of God. And in light of the evidence, it becomes really ridiculous after a while. The flood, the fact that we have so many fossils is because of rapid burial. It's because of the flood. It's the only explanation. And they try to say ancient seas dried up and turned into mountains and all that sort of thing. But this summer in Moscow, one of the funniest ones, and I'll let you comment on this, Dr. Girard, I read on the front page of the Moscow Tribune that just stated as a fact that the dinosaurs were wiped out because a meteor hit the Earth. And you've probably heard this. This is truly what science tells us. A meteor hit the Earth and caused dust to go in the atmosphere, and all the dinosaurs died.
And again, if a meteor hit the Earth, why would it just selectively kill the dinosaurs? If the dust covered the Earth and it made it so dark that the dinosaurs died, you would expect all the plants to die long before the dinosaurs died. So if we had mass extinction of dinosaurs because of a meteor, we should have had mass extinction of everything. There's nothing selective about dinosaurs dying because of meteorite poisoning.
What's another theory?
Oh, the theory I was taught in school, and this is absolutely true. Dr. Hank Ziller, when I was in college, taught the theory that there was a plant which acted like a laxative, which became extinct. Now, when this laxative plant all died out, the dinosaurs couldn't get their laxative, and they got constipated and all became extinct because they died. And we called it the exploding dinosaur theory, and that was legitimately proposed to us, and that was the right answer on the test.
Well, a good thing you got it down in your notes. Let's go to the phones. Bruce, you're on Direct Line. Thanks for calling.
Yes, Dr. Girard, I wanted to ask your opinion on the canopy theory, the idea that Earth's atmosphere was filled with a more amount of water than it is today.
Okay. The canopy theory, I'll tell you the good and the bad on it. Let me just say this. The canopy theory comes from the statement in Genesis that God separated the waters above from the waters below. A lot of speculation about what the firmament was, what the waters above were. Dr. Henry Morris and Dr. John Wickham back in 61 had promoted this idea of an invisible water vapor canopy suspended above the earth, held up there by various forces. Some more recent work done by Chafin and Larry Vardaman, Dr. Vardaman, said that if you use the model of atmospheric pressure and altitude based upon NASA's concept that they generated, that you would get a tremendous amount of atmospheric pressure and heat generated from a water vapor canopy, and that really you couldn't generate a canopy any more than about 5 inches thick. Dr. Carl Ball, rather a physicist working with him, has promoted this concept of taking the canopy further out in space, about 11 miles above the Earth, where you're going to get temperatures between negative 130 and negative 180 degrees Fahrenheit, and that it would turn to ice, literally support itself, and be completely pure water, transparent, and allow for light to come in without melting because of the extreme temperatures that are up there. Let me say this. This is science offering an explanation for what we see in the scriptures. There's no proof of it, obviously. This is just a bunch of people saying, scientists saying, let's take a scientific approach and see if it'll fit. If there was either one of these canopies, though, we would expect to see a tropical greenhouse effect prior to the flood, and these canopies would have provided the water for the flood. But and again, both theories are being run around the circles in the peer review journals, in the creation science journals right now, and we'll just see what kind of comes out of it.
Now, Dr. Gerard, the implications of the water canopy, as you're mentioning, the greenhouse effect, I know from the scriptures Adam lived to be over 900 years old, but after the flood, you know, people lived to be about 80. Now, we know about reptiles, which dinosaurs would be. Reptiles continue to keep growing as long as they're alive. So I know we found like 15-foot, 20-foot alligators here in, on this side of the flood. But let's say an alligator lived to be 930 years old, like Adam or something, in this greenhouse effect caused by the canopy. How big would that alligator be?
Oh, it'd be giant. And that's why when we see these very large dinosaurs, the canopy would deflect a lot of harmful UV radiation that we current theory about what causes the aging process is genetic mutations in the mitochondrial DNA that causes cell breakdown. If you can filter out a lot of that ultraviolet radiation, which a canopy would deflect and filter out a good bit of it, then you can prolong life. You could slow down the aging process drastically. That's consistent with what we see in the Bible listed for the ages of people. Pre-flood, in the range of 900 years. Post-flood, rapidly dropping off.
Bruce, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. 447-5495. We've got a couple of lines available. Let's talk to Lauren. You're on Direct Line.
Hi, I'd just like to say first, Mr. Gale and Mr. Larry, I really like your show, In Defense of the Faith.
Thank you.
And my question is, are dinosaurs still alive? Because my friends are like, well, they're still alive and all that stuff. So are they still alive?
Lauren, there's a possibility that dinosaurs are still alive, and I'd like to think that they are. Dr. Mackel says that they could be, but there's if you don't have the book, The Great Dinosaur Mystery, you may want to get your mom and dad to get that book for you. But I hope the dinosaurs are still alive, but there's a possibility that most of them are all extinct, so we'd better see them real soon.
Although you still have stories about, like, the Loch Ness Monster that some people think might be a dinosaur. And we got into it earlier in the show about that, on all the different sightings around the world.
Lauren, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Scott, you're on Direct Line.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
A question for the doctor there. Back to good old National Geographic.
Okay.
They had articles that have described, back especially during the International Geophysical Year, but it had to do with the ocean floor and the layers coming up from the cracks at the in the ocean.
Okay.
And that the magnetic pole shifts in different segments of the soil, and they were using that to count to base
right.
their age on the continental drift theory.
Exactly. Paleomagnetism has been promoted as one of the old age indicators. The problem with that for the evolutionist is that when we look at these how the magnetic fields in these different rock layers line up, the evolutionist wants to believe that over hundreds of millions of years, those rocks were laid down slowly, and the Earth's magnetic field reversed itself at various times slowly. The problem with that is that you can't get the first thing without the second, and the first thing that they can't get is a magnetic field. The only theory that fits all of the physics that we know is to have a free decay magnetic field inside the center of the Earth. That would very rapidly, certainly less than 4.5 billion years, completely expire. Now, the theory of a free decay field, and the evidence does show that there's been large-scale reversals of the magnetic field in the past. The thing is whether or not those reversals occurred quickly or slowly. And within about the last year and a half from some lava flow samples, it's apparent that those magnetic reversals occurred very, very rapidly, which would fit with the reversals we see all around the world. Dr. Russ Humphreys has written a very good monograph on that from the Institute for Creation Research. If you write to ICR and ask for impact article number 242, Dr. Humphreys gives a real quick explanation with some of his evidences. If you want a more technical discussion, he did a monograph in 1991 for the Creation Research Society, and you can write to them for their, June of 90 monograph, in which he discusses the decay of the Earth's magnetic field. But the new evidence for rapid reversals in these magnetic fields has been very damaging to the evolutionist cause to put billions of years of age. Now, Dr. Humphreys has done a very strict mathematical analysis and demonstration that these rapid reversals of the magnetic field would have coincided with a lot of volcanic activity during a worldwide flood. And he believes that the evidence fits perfectly with that. And
would that give a uniform change or throughout the world at various points?
No. It would create various niduses, if you will, various locations of reversals in the magnetic field, okay? All having a tendency to line up, but very large local areas covering hundreds, thousands of miles of reversals superimposed upon adjacent areas, okay, hundreds of miles away, where you would have exactly the opposite orientation, and that's what they found.
Our guest today, Dr. Michael Girard of the Institute for Creation Research. Once again, before the end of the program, we'll give you the address for ICR and a number you can call for some other bits and pieces of information. Also joining us today, Larry Wessels. A couple of things that were brought up earlier or throughout the program I wanted to touch on before we run out of time. One of those being the issue of fossilization. People think that it takes millions and billions of years for fossils to form. Is that the truth?
It doesn't. In fact, in this edition of Creation Research Quarterly, they talk about a gentleman that did an experiment over several months where he was able to go to Yellowstone Park and fossilize various pieces of wood just by putting them down in the geysers. Dr. Steve Alston at the Institute for Creation Research said that they had done a project where they tied chicken bones to a rope and lowered it down into those geysers, and they fossilized very, very quickly. Matter of weeks, about 3-4 weeks, they got fossilized chicken bones. So that fossilization can occur very, very quickly. You don't need a lot of time, but you need the right conditions, and that's for everything.
Dr., what about oil?
And oil, coal, we've been able to go in the laboratory and form oil in a matter of days, hours, actually. Coal, we can do exactly the same thing. At Mount St. Helens, where we've had this tremendous eruption of a volcano back in 1980, we see at the bottom of Spirit Lake this tremendous peat layer. Dr. Alston says that if you had another eruption of the volcano, the heat would turn that peat layer into a gigantic seam of coal, and that would happen instantaneously within a day or so. So that what you need is not a lot of time, but the right conditions. Things that we were always taught took a lot of time really don't. Just a comment on oil. Back in 1967, this was reported in Science magazine, some research was done on high-pressure oil wells off the Louisiana coast in the Gulf of Mexico. These oil wells become gushers when they finally tap into them, and the oil shoots out all over the place because of the tremendous gas accumulation and the pressure that's built up in this oil well. The only problem is, the rock that that oil well sits in, the surrounding rock, is very porous. And within a matter of 10,000 years, all the gas would have leaked out the rock. So why is there still the pressure there? That's a very young well.
Let's talk about dating. You mentioned young well. How about young Earth and old Earth theories? That has a lot to do with the fossilization, or at least people's impression about fossilization, that this is an old, old Earth, and creation just doesn't fit into that picture.
Well, again, fossils are pointed to as being part of the old Earth dating method. They look at the fossils. They say, well, they had to take millions of years to form. We know fossils form rapidly. You can fossilize something quickly. We also know that in order to form a fossil, you have to bury that creature quickly. When I was in school, we were taught that you had to bury the creature slowly over thousands or millions of years with mud and water. The truth is if you don't bury that creature within a matter of days or weeks, it'll completely decompose. And I do this all the time. I tell folks, take a dead cat, put it on your front lawn, leave it there for a month, come back and look at it. It didn't form a fossil. It disappeared. So fossilization occurs quickly. Fossils don't prove an old dating method. We have dating methods that, according to the evolutionists, date things to be hundreds of millions or billions of years old. A lot of folks ask me, well, Dr. Giraud, what about carbon-14? Doesn't it date things to be millions and billions of years old? First thing, carbon-14 does not date rocks. Carbon-14 is only good for dates that are under 50,000 years, and some scientists would say it's only good for dates in the area of 5,000 years. So carbon-14 is not for dating rocks. The dating methods that are for dating rocks, things like potassium argon and uranium lead, are dating methods that don't give accurate dates. And this is what I mean by that. If we take those dating methods, let's just take potassium argon because that's been done, and we go out to rocks that we know how old they are, lava flows, and we date those lava flows, 200-year-old lava flows will give us dates anywhere from 16 million years old to 1.6 billion years old. But those rocks are only 200 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So if I've got a measuring device that's that poor with regard to accuracy, it's not a good measuring device.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, and I wanted you to be able to give to our audience, if you could, maybe a brief rundown of some of the main points that you feel like would disprove some of the main areas of evolution that you feel like the facts just don't stand up.
The most important thing for evolution is, can you get life from non-life? Can chemicals come together to form life? That's what the evolutionist has to believe. And that is so overwhelmingly no. The laws of chemistry and physics say that can never, ever occur. You need to put information into our DNA to get the DNA code. You don't program a computer by sticking a firecracker in it and exploding it. You don't print books by throwing a bomb in a print shop and hoping the letters fall together. You need information in your DNA, which is a code. It's an alphabet to form everything that you see around us, all living systems. The laws of chemistry and physics and the second law of thermodynamics as it applies to information theory says you can never get information from non-information. The second thing is that the fossil record says that evolution did not occur. In Biloxi River, we have footprints of humans inside of dinosaur footprints. We find no transitional forms. That strongly speaks against evolution. And finally, evolution says that things go from simple to complex, and what we always see is that things go the other way.
Check out our websites. BibleQuery.org. This site answers 7,700 Bible questions. HistoryCart.com. This site reveals early church history and doctrine, proving Roman Catholicism is not historically or doctrinally viable. MuslimHope.com. This site is a classic refutation of Islam, a counterfeit religion created by Muhammad. Free newsletters are also available.